The Michigan Department of Natural Resources is a unique unit of state government, offering considerable benefit per state tax dollar. The DNR's $409 million budget is less than 1% of the state's overall spending plan, with only 14% coming directly from state tax revenues. Yet it supports a broad range of outdoor sport, recreation, research, and conservation activities, helping to add billions of dollars to the state economy. We'll look at all that bang for the buck as we discuss some current DNR issues and programs with the agency's deputy director, just ahead on Media Meet. Hello and welcome to WNMU's Media Meet. I'm Bill Hart. Our guest is Michigan Department of Natural Resources Deputy Director Bill O'Neill. Joining me on the panel, Country 103 FXD outdoor show host Adam Carpenter. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Neill, you're a graduate of Michigan State University. You've served with the DNR for over 30 years.
I have.
Having spent most of that time in forest management, which included administering the largest state forest in the country, as a matter of fact. So, effective last August, you now administer just about all the divisions of the agency. How do you view your role and responsibilities as deputy director?
Well, it's deputy director is much broader than the forestry chief that I was. And I did get some special training in Felch when I had my first forester job out of college. Loved working there and living in Crystal Falls and Iron Mountain. But the deputy director job, it's diverse in that we're looking at all the programs, fisheries, forestry, wildlife, parks, and we're a world-class agency. We lead in all of those. Some of our forest management, our wildlife management, fisheries management programs are world-class. And so being a part of those is exciting.
Okay. I'd like to get some observations on the agency budget. The Michigan DNR is largely a pay-to-play department. The bills are paid from 60 different funds, many of which depend on user fees from outdoor and resource-based activities. Yet about 17% of the budget comes from federal dollars. That's around $70 million on my count. We've seen some shifts in federal discretionary spending in the last couple of years. Do you see any immediate threats to the DNR's bottom line from federal sources? Mm-hmm.
I really don't. I don't see any immediate threats. Lots of our federal funding comes from Pittman-Robertson or Dingell-Johnson funding.
Okay.
And that's taxes.
Those
on
are fixed funding.
On shooting sports and fishing equipment and that. And we've actually seen that increase over the last decade or so. There's been a little decrease in some of that tax revenue, but as an immediate threat, no, I don't think so.
Okay,
we're in pretty good shape.
Let's look at Michigan. State restricted funds account for some 67% of the DNR budget, but 14% comes from the general fund. Does that seem secure for now?
Yeah, I think it does. I think we're a credible organization, and folks like to invest in it. And our customers, you mentioned pay to play, it is a pay to play. You know, our customers are the ones that are funding natural resources. So if we have healthy natural resources in Michigan, it's because our customers are willing to invest in that, and we appreciate that, whether it's a hunting and fishing license or whatever it is that they buy.
Okay.
I personally would spend twice as much as I do on my fishing licenses, so I think it's a real value. My opinion.
Yeah, I think I agree too. And it's a good way to keep our natural resources healthy. And that's what our sportsmen want. So whether you're fishing, hunting, you're a trail user, you're paying camping fees, you want a good experience. And we certainly have that in Michigan.
The Lake Superior Fishery Advisory Committee met in April. It was reported that there were abundant coho salmon last year, good steelhead numbers. Whitefish down slightly and lake trout about the same. A hot topic seems to be emerging, bag limits for lake trout. What's behind that issue and do you see any changes ahead?
Yeah, there's an interesting discussion going on. Should we reduce lake trout bag limits, especially when you're talking about Big Reef and Standard Rock. You're going all the way out there, and are those fish populations healthy, and should we consider that? So there is a discussion with the advisory group, should we go down? Right now, I think the recommendation is to stay the same, but I think we're looking at that. So I just saw our research boat, the Arctic Char, that's docked here in Marquette, and they're going to be doing specific research and hopefully some population estimates out there this summer that'll help us make a more informed decision. But but that's a, I think that's an interesting discussion between our customers and our fish biologists. What is the best way to go? So we have that with many different species across the entire state.
I know Standard Rock is sort of a, one of those little points that people like to bring up when they talk about maybe overfishing or something. What have you heard about that, Dan?
Well, my personal experience at Standard Rock is it is the lake trout factory of the UP as far as in our geographical region here near Marquette anyway. And I would be interested to know from some of your reputable biologists, which I do think you have some excellent fisheries biologists,
that we do,
if there would be any benefit to having any sort of slot limit as well to help.
Let's explain slot.
Sure.
Limit is a limit based on size, usually, right?
Mm-hmm. Plays a factor in what you
to make sure that there's enough research stock there, right?
You see it a lot in walleye fisheries.
Okay.
So with lake trout, you know, there's a lot of discussion about letting the biggest breeders go, letting the biggest fish, which quite frankly don't usually taste the best either, so they're a nice photo opportunity, and if you can get them back healthy, they'll continue to breed. But I'm interested to see if there would be a possibility at looking at that, if, if it was in the budget for that kind of research.
Yeah, it is. Actually, that conversation about Big Reef and Standard Rock includes slot limits. So should we change the take? Should we go from 5 to 3 or 5 to something and then include a slot limit in there? So I think we're considering a whole range of suggestions, and when we get some more data, we'll start to have conversations with our customers and see what the best regulation will be.
Okay. Speaking of fishing, upgrades had been slated for the Thompson Fish Hatchery, Manistique. What upgrades and what's the expected outcome?
Yeah,
for
that's
anglers?
Really been, that's a fabulous investment. So our fisheries folks are...
$12.5 million, was
yeah,
that the investment?
Yeah, $12.5 million. They're going to build a new cold water building there that will help us rear additional walleye and additional muskie, and then we're going to build some ponds that will help us grow those fish so we can put more stocking. And then there's going to be additional capacity for over 200,000 additional steelhead that we'll be able to stock. So our hatcheries are really a important part of who we are in DNR Fisheries, and we're able to invest in upgrades and all of those. We're also going to put a deep water well in. Certainly water movement in a hatchery is really important.
Yeah.
So the quality of the water is fundamental, and that's going to help us in making the hatchery all it can be.
Okay. The Wildlife Division received about $2.6 million in general fund money this year to combat wildlife diseases. I know this is a topic of special interest to Adam, including $1 million in one-time funds for chronic wasting disease, a key threat to the state's deer population. And so far, not quite as bad here. At least five counties are affected downstate, but still no CW deer identified in the UP, as I understand.
That's correct. Yep. And
despite a proximity to infected areas in Wisconsin, how's the effort going to keep it that way?
Well, we're doing everything we can. An earlier conversation with Adam, this is probably the biggest issue we have in front of the department today. We've got CWD in counties down in south central, southwest Michigan, and we don't want it in the UP. So we've got it close in Wisconsin, and it's in southern Michigan. So we're putting together a list of recommendations that we can do in Michigan to help fight, that will help slow the spread and reduce the prevalence of CWD in our deer herd. So, but you're right, we don't have it in the UP today. And when you talk about disease, we've got a number of emerging diseases in wildlife, from TB in deer that we've had for probably the last couple of decades, to avian influenza that affects waterfowl, EHD, which is another bug-borne pathogen that attacks deer, and across the Midwest, that's really a difficult disease for deer. It can knock the populations down, similar to what a bad winter will do here in other areas. So that disease funding goes all the way across, whether it's West Nile and grouse and some other diseases.
Would these all be natural occurring things in, quote, a state of nature?
Yes, but not here. You know, usually it's occurring in nature, but you hope it's not in your backyard. And when it comes in your backyard, it becomes a problem. So CWD is a significant problem. It's related to a number of diseases, scrapies in sheep and others. Never been in Michigan before. First popped up out west, but it's here now. It's actually in 26 states and provinces across the nation.
Okay. You got some observations?
Well, there's a ton of questions that are spurned from this particular topic, and I would say, first of all, I think there is a desperate need for a tremendous amount of effort toward education, because obviously fear breeds ignorance, and there are a lot of people that, including myself, I still don't know if I have a full handle on exactly how CWD is going to affect the Upper Peninsula, because I do believe it is coming, whether we like it or not. It's just a matter of mitigating it. And the biggest concern I have is that there really isn't another place in the country that has the situation where we have winter range deer, summer range deer. They travel back and forth, sometimes a tremendous amount of miles. Mm-hmm. And how is that going to impact the spread of CWD if it does make it to the UP? And I know there's a study going on. Mm-hmm. The question I think becomes, what are the decisions that need to be made right now before all of that data comes back from this study?
Mm-hmm. There's been a couple of suggestions. It's been suggested that keeping CWD out of the UP depends on preventing the transport of whole deer and elk carcasses into the region altogether. As I understand it, you can remove part of the mm-hmm. the animal and safely transport the rest. That's correct. Is that correct?
Yep, that is correct. So we'd like bone meat moved. Okay. So you don't want any brain material or any spinal cord material. So the best thing to do is, if you go out west and hunt, if you hunt anywhere, bone your meat, package it up, and then bring it in. That's the way we'd like to transport venison coming into the UP, or actually coming in anywhere in Michigan. So now it's illegal to import a whole deer into the state to try to help with that.
What about between the downstate and the Upper Peninsula?
It's still legal to bring a deer in, but that, when we're talking about what are we going to do, what are we going to consider, one of the considerations is, well, how do we move deer within the state of Michigan? Because just the UP doesn't want CWD, whether it comes from Wyoming, Wisconsin, or the Lower Peninsula. And the northeast part of the Lower Peninsula doesn't want it coming from the southwest. So we've got that conversation. How can we increase our biosecurity in carcass movement that will slow the spread of the disease? So those are the conversations that we're having. Last fall, we had a symposium in Lansing, or really a world CWD symposium, where we brought experts from around the country in, and we're trying to learn some of that. Em's right, there's so much that we don't know about CWD, it's difficult to know what path is best to move forward with.
Okay, I have to take a moment here to remind our viewers, and especially our radio listeners, that we're talking about outdoor issues with Michigan DNR Deputy Director Bill O'Neill. Joining me on the panel, Country 103 FXD Outdoor Show host Adam Carpenter. There's also a matter of deer moving on the hoof. One of the suggestions is reducing the number of young bucks to limit migration, which is a natural part of their life. What's your assessment on that?
Well, the bucks do move, especially young bucks oftentimes are nudged out to go find a new territory. So when you're looking at slowing the spread, Do you try to minimize that movement? And if you do, how do you do it? Do you look to advantage the take of young bucks? Also, the older the deer gets, the more likely it will come down with CWD if it's in the area. So if CWD is in your area, do you look at trying to reduce the older doe population along with younger bucks? So those are the conversations that we're having to try to structure rules and regulations that will help slow that spread and slow that prevalence.
It's interesting, coming at it from two directions. Mm-hmm. Of course, the big question appears to be what's being done to reduce the chances of a live deer bringing CWD into the UP from Wisconsin, because they're only, I don't know, the last figure I saw was 30 miles away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is close. It's very close. Adam mentioned a study that we have going in the west end of the UP that tracks deer movement. We need to better understand that movement when they're moving from winter range to summer range, and where are they congregating and how are they congregating. So we have a number of deer collared. We're tracking their movements with GPS, and that study will give us a lot of good information. Adam also mentioned something that's important is the information and education. So in the UP, we had a CWD task force formed, local citizens getting together and saying, we're concerned about CWD, what can we do? So CWD has been a part of the conversation in the UP for a year or longer as a result of their good work. So I wanted to put a shout out to them. They're doing great work.
Okay. Let's talk about deer health generally. The late winter impact on UP deer raised a lot of concern. The April cold and snow pushed some stress limits, and perhaps mortality way up. What's the assessment at this point? How healthy is that population?
Yeah, it did stress them. Anytime you get
a lot of younger deer.
Yeah, it did. Yeah. So did we have some deer mortality? Yeah, we did. How much? We're not exactly sure. Up until that point, the winter had been okay. But anytime you get significant cold or significant snow late in the winter, early in the spring, that's when the deer are least capable of surviving that. So that hurts them. Was it as bad as the few winters ago that we had?
No, we had a few bad ones.
Yeah, nothing like that. But it certainly didn't help at a time that they're least able to deal with severe winter.
That was an unusual snap. The Forest Resources Division has a roughly $49 million budget, funded largely by private timber harvesting from state forests and by the U.S. Forest Service. Lately, the agency's been drawing revenue from a program authorized in 2014 under the Farm Bill to assist the Forest Service on timber and watershed restoration. Can you tell us about the Good Neighbor Authority and how it's working in Michigan, specifically in the UP?
Sure, be glad to. I'll start out by saying forestry in Michigan is a big deal. It's a $20 billion industry. It employs almost 100,000 people. We got great plants in the Upper Peninsula, whether you're talking about Potlatch or Verso or any of the number of small sawmills that we have. It employs a lot of folks and it creates a lot of wildlife habitat. So,
great diversity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the programs that we've partnered with the Forest Service is Good Neighbor Authority. It allows state employees to go on federal land and actually put up timber. And we put up timber according to the plans that the Forest Service has developed. But right now, they don't have the capacity to do the management. So they have a plan that says they want to do A, B, and C, but they don't have the capacity. They don't have the people to actually get the work done. So
does that mean they're imposing their rules on your system, or are you allowed to use your own system?
Yeah, we're actually, so Congress authored this Good Neighbor Authority that gave us the opportunity to use our rules on their land. And we manage a lot of timber in Michigan. We think we're pretty good at it. We think we're a world leader. So I think some of our rules and regulations will certainly work on Forest Service land, and we've been able to help them accomplish objectives on tens of thousands of acres, and we're going to continue to do that into the future.
What's the advantage for state forest land management of this kind of a program?
Lots of advantages. There's economic advantages. So as I said, it's a $20 billion industry. That industry needs supply. We need to supply that industry, and it employs a lot of folks, so there's an economic advantage to that. Forestry also provides significant habitat enhancement. So if you're talking about deer, if you're talking about bear, grouse, woodcock, all of those species benefit from forestry and forest management. So if you're looking at a wildlife perspective, you want forest management on the landscape. And lastly, a forest health. So our forests don't last forever. These aren't long-lived forests. Our spruce balsam might get to 75 years old, and we're seeing quite a die-off in spruce balsam right now. Most of that resource is old. So from a forest health perspective, forestry really helps.
Also, health and diversity don't stop at the boundaries of any particular forest. You have to look pretty broadly, right?
Yeah, you do. So we're fortunate to have the public land that we have. We have Forest Service land. We have state land, and then we have commercial forest, and then we have individuals who own their camps and 40 acres, and you're right in that Good habitat has to go all the way across that landscape.
Folks, with actual private land too, you know, one of the things that I have talked about quite extensively on my show is the winter habitat work group that you mm-hmm. also have,
mm-hmm.
and how you have helped implement some habitat changes for the deer herd that
yep.
actually are in the heavy snowfall zones of the UP. And another side point on forestry, you have an excellent series, the Wildlife Through Forestry series, mm-hmm. which folks can find out a lot more about how forestry has really helped different species.
Mm-hmm.
One that just happened last week, a songbird forum here at NMU.
Yeah.
We had the raptor one just before that.
Mm-hmm.
And the list goes on and on. I mean, forestry can be a wonderful habitat improvement.
Yep, yep, you're right. And that here again, our habitat work group that's done great work over the last couple of years, it's a group of interested citizens getting together to say, how can we improve winter deer habitat? And so they're working with the Forest Service, they're working with the Soil Conservation Districts, Safari Club International has helped. There's been a number of partners doing good things to help promote healthy habitat for winter deer herd.
And it extends on to private land, too.
Yeah, that certainly does, yeah.
Let's talk about that the input. With 86% of the DNR budget coming from sources other than state taxes, the emphasis, I think, is on service and sustainability. It's anglers, hunters, boaters, snowmobilers, campers, all those people that actually fund the improvements and maintenance. So users are playing a big role, and a big role is advisors. Case in point, currently the agency is seeking public input on ORV rules
mm-hmm.
For state forest roads. What occasioned that, and what kind of input are you looking for?
Sure. So last year, Public Act 288 was passed. That requires us to map all of the roads on state property and then determine whether those roads should be open to ORV use or not. In the UP, the rule has always been open unless posted closed. In the Lower Peninsula, it was closed unless posted open. It had far more consequence in the Lower Peninsula than it will have here. Mm-hmm. But still, we want to know from our customers what road should be open, what road should be closed. What area do we need to protect against motorized use if we need to protect it? And what area do we need to develop for motorized use so folks can go out and enjoy the trails and enjoy our natural resources?
Okay.
I love this idea, by the way, of having the UP open unless otherwise posted closed, because it seems that it would bring up individual points that would be issues, individual roads that would be issues that should be closed versus just saying, well, they're all closed unless we tell you they're open.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
One of the things I love about living in the Upper Peninsula is we have a vast amount of accessible outdoor forests, mm-hmm. outdoor land that, you know, one of the things is riding four-wheeler
yep.
around or taking a snowmobile to go find powder out in the plains somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, I love the idea of open unless otherwise posted closed, and I think most Upper Peninsula residents would agree with that.
Yeah, I think so too. And our trail user groups, you talk about partners. They're partners in trail development. They do just a great job, and they're out there using natural resources, which is what we all want.
Let's talk about that a little, the input a little more. The DNR has identified a site in Sands Township for what would be the first public shooting range in the UP. It's reported there may be a conflict with a nearby proposed animal shelter, and Zoning and Planning Commission approvals were pending at the time I did some of this research, but safety and noise were considerations for Sands residents. The agency wants to invest up to $1 million from firearm user taxes in a state-of-the-art public range. How does it look at this point?
Well, we're having conversations with the local units of government. You know, we're not going to jump in and go do this if the locals don't support it. So we're having that. And sometimes those are more involved conversations. So we've had some public meetings to talk about that so we can quantify what are the impacts, how loud is it, how loud isn't, did we measure it? And so we've taken some of that information to the public meetings. And I think we're going to get somewhere. It just takes a conversation, and it takes a little while to make decisions.
Complicating this a bit is that people seem to support shooting out there. They don't necessarily support the range.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I understand that.
That's true. I mean, whether you want a shooting range there or not, there already is one.
Yeah.
There really is already.
And
it has been for a long time.
Without a range, then it's probably less safe than it would be under under a secure kind of environment,
yep.
right?
Yep. That's
and
true.
It's also noisier because the abatement and things that the DNR has proposed in the shooting range would actually lower the noise level.
Okay. I have to mention this. Federal government has decided to delist the once-endangered Kirtland's warbler, a move that represents something of a success story in conservation circles. What does that mean for the DNR and concerned citizens?
Yeah, it really is a celebration. So we've got a number of endangered species. Anytime we can bring an endangered species back where it's not endangered anymore, this is a good thing. And there was a great tie with forestry. So that little bird needs young jack pine forests.
Right.
So in the absence of forestry, you won't have that management in those young forests. So it's been a great partnership with forest industry and wildlife to bring back just a neat little bird. And the bird's smart enough to live in northern Michigan in the summer and then go to the Bahamas in the winter. So that's a bird you want to keep around.
This is just one more forestry-related question, actually one that came up from something I read. This month, two Michigan residents, downstate Michigan residents, were busted for tapping over 220 gallons of maple sap on state land. What's the law there? Is there a law against syrup poaching or sap poaching?
Well, yeah, there is. We don't get a lot of syrup poachers, but you get all kinds sometimes. So in order to do that, you're going to have to get a permit. And okay. So,
but you can get a permit.
Yeah, you can. Get a permit. But there's reasons why we would and wouldn't permit it. So if we're trying to grow that sugar maple tree to make a board, and then we drill a hole in that, that's probably, we may have invested 75 years into that tree only to have it devalued to get a little bit of sap out of it. And you know, then you get hoses that make it difficult for wildlife to move. So there's, you know, we're careful about where we permit that and where we don't.
Okay. Porcupine Mountain State Park, the UP's largest, is reportedly suffering from overcrowding, requiring officials to cut back on the number of registered campsites. The park is 60,000 acres. Could you explain the measure and why it's being taken?
Sure. So this is dispersed camping. This is where you and I put our tent and our sleeping bag and bedroll and walk into the park and camp where we want.
I see.
And so it's a wilderness experience. And there, Wilderness State Park is one of the best places in the world to do that. But most folks that do that want to go and camp and be by themselves. They want to be in the wilderness. So if we have a growing population that's doing that, so we drive 300 miles, walk 30 miles, get in the middle of it, only to find a whole bunch of people, that's not the experience they're looking for. So we're trying to figure out what's the right number. And so we're going to limit that and see, we'll see what happens over the next year or two to see if we can't get the right number so people get the experience that they came to get. And so we can at least have as many people as possible get that experience. So
okay, I'm afraid we have to leave it there for time. We've been talking about outdoor issues with Michigan Department of Natural Resources Deputy Director Bill O'Neill. Joining us on the panel, Country 103 FXD Outdoor Show host Adam Carpenter. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Bill Hart. See you next time on Media Meet.
The preceding program was produced in studios located in the Edgar L. Hardin Learning Resources Center by WNMU-TV, Northern Michigan University Public Television.